It's early morning on the banks of the River Ganges in Varanasi, India's oldest and holiest city. As the sun comes up and turns the pink sky gold, around 300 people are taking part in a mass yoga class. This public yoga session for tourists was introduced 2 years ago by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. He calls yoga India's gift to the world. But how much do modern yoga classes really reflect its ancient Indian traditions? I'm Mukti Jane Campion, and in this BBC World Service documentary, I'll be exploring the secret history of yoga.
So Virasana, the kneeling position.
Yoga is practiced by millions of people around the world.
You sit between your feet.
This is an Iyengar class, one of the most widely practiced styles of yoga.
You may need to sit on a block. Many of us do these days because we've got tight knees, tight hips.
And this is Bikram hot yoga, where the class is put through its postures in a studio heated to over 40 degrees Celsius.
Right foot between your palms, lower your left.
Or you can also download one of the many yoga phone apps now available to help you practice on your own.
Step forward.
So how did yoga come to be something that so many people are now willing to pay to learn and put in hours to practice? I've been attending yoga classes in London for over 20 years, and it's become an important part of my weekly routine, a time to relax, stretch and breathe.
Exhale, fatigue, tension.
Over the years, I've learned how to bend my body into shapes with exotic and ancient-sounding Sanskrit names. And being of Indian origin myself, it's felt good to connect with a rich Indian spiritual tradition, one which I imagined had been handed down from guru to pupil over generations. Books on yoga I occasionally read described it as a timeless discipline, going back thousands of years. But recently, I came across a book called Yoga Body, The Origins of Modern Posture Practice, which challenged all my assumptions to their very core. Its author is historian Dr. Mark Singleton.
What my research has shown is that so-called Swedish gymnastics in the latter half of the 19th century without a doubt influenced the way that yoga developed in certain places in India. And as a result, the ways of understanding and practicing yoga changed substantially.
Could the yoga now practiced so widely around the world actually owe its origins as much to 19th century Scandinavian gymnastic drills as to ancient Indian philosophy? It was a startling thought. What had I been practicing all these years? I met up with Mark at the British Library, where he showed me some of the exercise manuals that first sparked his interest.
1925. Primary gymnastics. The basis for rational physical development.
This is a book called Primary Gymnastics by Niels Buch, a Dane, a teacher of gymnastics, whose system was based on Ling gymnastics, an earlier form of Scandinavian gymnastics. Ling gymnastics is a kind of curative gymnastics, so not just keep fit, which quickly became the basis for military training across Europe and in Britain also, and then is exported to India as military training and also in schools.
From the heels, sit.
Buch system, there's a lot more movement. It's a lot more aerobic. There's much more of an emphasis on stretching.
Promoting suppleness, strength and agility to produce sturdy working youth.
His system became very popular. By 1930, it was the second most prevalent form of physical culture practice in India, after Ling gymnastics, which was number one, according to a YMCA survey of the time.
Niels Buch's Keep Fit manual is profusely illustrated with black and white photographs of young people doing his gymnastic drills. For Mark Singleton, who had himself long practiced a dynamic form of yoga called Ashtanga, the images looked strangely familiar.
I was struck by a significant number of body postures that resembled yoga poses and that could be named as yoga poses, such as here the downward dog, the cat pose, 20 or 30 poses that look like yoga poses but that aren't.
What was going on? Had Buch borrowed from Indian yoga, or was it the other way around?
I'm pretty sure that Book did not get his postures from India.
This is because by the end of the 19th century, physical posture practice appears to have become largely obsolete and even frowned upon, particularly by Europeans, as the Strand magazine of London reported in 1897.
For the most part, the Brahmin yogas seen in India are repulsive. They've been known to stand on the roadside for years with one hand or leg extended motionless in one position until the sinews and ligaments wither and the limb becomes immovably fixed. Their arms, too, are occasionally shriveled to mere parchment-covered bones, with fingernails growing inches long through the palms. Others have shriveled feet and toenails like the claws of a bird.
Not a look you'd want to copy. The celebrated champion of the Hindu Renaissance, Swami Vivekananda, who was invited to talk at the 1893 World Parliament of Religions in Chicago, is usually credited with introducing yoga to the West. But it turns out he wasn't keen on physical postures either.
At the same time that this article comes out, we have Swami Vivekananda, who has been in America by this time already 4 years, has published the book which will form a kind of blueprint for subsequent practical do-it-yourself experiments in yoga, and has taught the first yoga class to a group of Westerners, but who, quite surprisingly, given what we think of as yoga today, has not taught any postures. He's teaching meditation, he's teaching pranayama and visualizations. So there he is in America, having great success, being welcomed with open arms, and of course will subsequently return to India as a hero, and at the same time omitting postures.
So how did yoga in the West come to be primarily about learning a series of physical poses? And where did those poses originate? This has become the subject of increasing academic research. Mark Singleton is now part of a 5-year project at London's School of Oriental and African Studies, where historian Dr. Jim Mallinson is leading a team of European and Indian scholars to investigate the evolution of yoga postures, known in Sanskrit as asanas.
For coming up into sitting cross-legged position, back straight, eyes closed.
In the earliest analyses of yoga practice from about 2,000 years ago, the postures associated with it are seated positions. The lotus position is the classic example, but there are 8 or 9 others are listed in Patanjali's Yoga Shastra from about the 4th or 5th century CE.
Patanjali's Yoga Sutras are widely regarded as the oldest guide to yoga. He describes 8 paths to ultimate liberation. These include ethical conduct, such as truthfulness and non-violence, as well as practices of sensory withdrawal and meditation. Only very few physical poses are mentioned.
They are firm, solid seated positions which, once mastered, you can kind of forget about your body and then just concentrate on meditation or breath control and so forth. It's not until perhaps the last 600 or 700 years that this notion of asana for physical well-being, for looking after the body, comes in. But it does, and we see a clear development in the textual tradition. From the earliest mentions in these texts from sort of 14th, 15th century, asana is said to make the body supple and thinner. It is actually specified that you will lose excess fat. But that's not really emphasized too much. Over the subsequent centuries, up to the 18th, 19th century, this becomes more and more a feature of certain new texts that are developed. And also asana becomes much more dynamic. So we get sort of squat thrusts, repeated prostrations, this kind of thing, or downward bends. Although then again, they are actually seen as techniques to prepare the body for the higher practices of yoga.
In India, at a picturesque hill station east of Mumbai, I visited the Lonavala Yoga Institute to meet the country's leading expert on traditional Indian yoga poses.
Nowadays, when I travel all over the world, I find different funny names of the yogas. I don't know why they want to use yoga, like, you know, dog yoga, wine yoga, nude yoga, beach yoga. Sorry to say, but there is no any mention of all such yogas in the ancient manuscripts.
Dr. Manmath Karote has devoted his life to tracking down ancient yoga manuscripts to understand what they tell us about the practice of yoga in the past.
How many people they know exactly what yoga is? Integration of personality is the prime aim of yoga. There are five aspects of personality: physical, mental, emotional, social and spiritual. Five different aspects of personality should work harmoniously with each other. Flexibility of the spine, flexibility of the joints, flexibility of the muscles is the prerequisite, important aspect of that. But it is not the ultimate aspect. So yoga says, although you practice asana through body, it is for the mind. As and when you are capable to stable your mind, then you can achieve complete eradication of the suffering, and then you go for the attaining eternal peace.
Few yoga classes today seem to aspire to such lofty goals. Most will take you through a series of postures that stretch and twist the spine in every direction.
The definition of health is very beautiful. It is not related to age. It is related to the condition of the spine. All the asanas designed in such a way that they will give proper training to your spine.
By now, I was intrigued to find out how many of the yoga postures practiced today actually have an ancient lineage.
Surya Namaskar, San Salut.
My Shivananda yoga class in London, led by Italian teacher Adonella Trabalza, begins with Surya Namaskar, Salute to the Sun, a dynamic sequence of 12 backward and forward bends.
Most of the people, they teach Surya Namaskar as yoga. But you will never find any reference about Surya Namaskar as yoga. Because what Patanjali says, asanas has two characteristics. Sthira, stability. Sukha, comfort. In Surya Namaskar, there is no sthirata, stability. It is a dynamic. And when dynamic exercises are there, it is not yoga.
And then as your back, support your back with your hands and come up into the shoulder stand.
The history of the shoulder stand, Sarvangasana, is taught relatively late. I think it's probably not until the 17th or 18th century.
Dr. Jim Mallinson.
But we do have earlier teachings on inverting the body. In yogic physiology, there's this notion that the life force, the vital essence, is produced in the head, is constantly dripping down and being expended. And one way to prevent this flow, which is the cause of death and old age, is to invert yourself. It's not specified how you do it. You can do a headstand or you can hang upside down from a tree.
And how about that most iconic of yoga poses, the downward dog?
And then in your own time, come up into the downward dog, invert every posture.
The downward dog, does that feature in any of your older texts?
Not until this 18th century text mentions a posture called Gajasana, actually it's called the elephant pose, but that corresponds to the downward dog of today.
All these years, I thought I was imitating a dog, and actually it was an elephant. No big deal, I like elephants. But this chopping and changing of names and poses really challenges the idea of yoga as a timeless discipline.
Stretching the spine sideways, Trikonasana, triangle.
I'm not aware of any references to Trikonasana, the triangle posture standing pose in ancient texts. There are no asymmetrical standing poses at all.
But it does have a Sanskrit name. Surely it must be old.
I'm aware that a lot of the asanas practiced today have Sanskrit names, but very few of these Sanskrit names are actually found in pre-modern Sanskrit texts. They seem to be modern neologisms.
Okay, so what's becoming clear is that the yoga I practice every week is very different to what was regarded as yoga 1,000 or even 100 years ago. But who was actually doing yoga in the past?
The practitioners of yoga par excellence over the historical record have been Hindu holy men, ascetics. Although I will add that it's not just Hindus, there are ascetics from Buddhist traditions and Jain traditions.
You're listening to the BBC World Service with me, Mukti Jain Campion, exploring the secret history of yoga. To sum up so far, it seems that all through its early history, the purposes and practices of yoga were continually changing. There was never any single monolithic yoga tradition. Prior to the 20th century, physical postures were far less important and don't appear to have had much popular appeal. But all that began to change in the early 20th century. Spurred on by the eugenics movement, there was a burgeoning worldwide interest in what became known as physical culture.
Gymnastics, bodybuilding, running, jumping, anything that will make the body fit, fast, strong, healthy.
Bodybuilders and wrestlers soon became the touring celebrities of the day. Men like the German-born Eugene Sandow, who measured statues of Greek gods in Italy in order to emulate their physique.
Semi-delirium seized the delighted dames and damsels when Sandow made the mountainous muscles of his arms wobble.
Sandow was the most accomplished and famous bodybuilder in the world.
Mark Singleton again.
And in 1902, he visited India, where he met with a hero's welcome. He was celebrated because he provided an accessible method that wasn't part of the apparatus of colonial oppression, with which Indians could build their bodies, become strong in the service of national emancipation.
This nationalist fervour is an important part of the story of yoga's evolution in the early 20th century. To prove their fitness for self-rule meant Indians demonstrating that their physical prowess was the equal of their colonial masters.
Not just taking Sandow's ideas, not just drawing from Western physical culture discourse, but also reviving Indian traditions of physical culture. Martial techniques of stick fighting, and also crucially bringing in asana and practices like Surya Namaskar, the sun salute, which become part of this wider vocabulary of physical culture, and which influence then the way that yoga itself is conceived and practiced.
One of the places that was at the forefront of that change was here at Kavalyatham, a yoga college established in Lonavala in 1924 by Swami Kuvalenanda, whose acolytes included many in the Indian freedom struggle, such as Gandhi and Nehru.
He was very much interested in physical education and yoga.
83-year-old Om Prakash Tiwari was a pupil of the Swami and has written his biography.
He tried to open college, national college, where he wanted to train the youth who can participate in the freedom fight. But this was banned by the British government, thinking that he will be preparing a revolution. Then he had an idea that yoga should be explained scientifically.
Tell me why he thought scientific experiments were necessary to prove yoga.
It was very rational thinking. He said, look here, you cannot give something to everyone. Suppose a person is having high blood pressure and you give him a topsy-turvy pose. It will go to a dangerous level.
Using X-rays and other then novel tools of medical science, this sort of experimentation helped to distance yoga from its unsavory association with those grizzled street corner yogis.
What we're seeing is a process of modernization. And in that process, aspects which aren't prior to this time part of the yoga system start to be incorporated.
It's during the 1930s that there seems to be the greatest experimentation, when some old asanas are revived and new ones are introduced. Perhaps the greatest innovator during this period was the hugely influential T. Krishnamacharya in the southern Indian city of Mysore, which was then a great centre for physical culture.
Krishnamacharya is said to have observed the exercises of a British army regiment in Mysore, and on the basis of what he saw, he's said to have decided that there should be more standing poses within yoga. His son says in some of his writing that he's amazed that his father is constantly bringing in these new postures. He is, like many of the yoga gurus around him, adapting and assimilating to what's going on at the time.
J.P. Muller, 1905. My system. 15 minutes work a day for health's sake.
This became the most popular home do-it-yourself exercise manual of the period.
J.P. Muller's book claims to improve on previous Scandinavian gymnastics and the methods of Sandow the bodybuilder, with chapter headings such as
Why Be Weakly?
And
Illness is generally one's own fault.
This is one of the cases in which we can show a clear influence from a do-it-yourself physical culture manual to the formation of a modern yoga system. Here we're talking in particular about the work of Sri Yogendra, who was one of the pioneers of yoga reconceived as practices for fitness and health. So he founded the earliest Yoga Research Institute in 1917 near Bombay. He subsequently traveled to the United States and set up a yoga institute in the United States. He probably gave the first ever postural yoga demonstration on American soil.
Sri Yogendra had himself been a bodybuilder in his youth and was known as Mr. Muscle. He went on to write one of the earliest manuals of yogic physical culture, where he adopts some of Mula's ideas quite openly.
So here we have a standing side-bending exercise, kind of twisting triangle posture, a lunge, a kind of warrior pose lunge in yogic terms, and we have photos of the time of Yogendra performing some of these very same things and naming Mula as one of his sources.
And women in the West are soon doing exercises that closely resemble those developing in India.
Building the Body Beautiful by Mrs. Bagot Stack, 1931. 15 minutes a day exercise on the Bagot Stack stretch and swing system.
Molly Bagot Stack was a Dublin-born woman who, in the early 20th century, travelled to India with her husband and learned some yoga postures from a teacher called Mr. Gopal, then subsequently returned to the UK and formed an organisation called the Women's League of Health and Beauty, which became the most popular women's exercise of the time.
Bucking Bronco, 1 minute a day. Purpose? Joint loosening and control of steady centre.
She's teaching gymnastics that are quite obviously inspired by what she's learned in India. So she's bringing in yoga poses, in particular the shoulder stand, Sarvangasana, which is a yoga posture. And this subsequently becomes the emblem of the Women's League of Health and Beauty, surprisingly, although its purposes are reconfigured.
Legs in the air. Purpose? Hip slimming and lift to sagging organs. Lie on the floor, feet overhead, elbows on the floor, hands under hips, legs up in the air. Exercise. Touch toes quickly, alternately on floor overhead. Keep knees straight and repeat for a phrase of foxtrot.
We also have forward bending poses, Paschimottanasana, the plough pose, and a number of postures which are, I think, quite clearly inspired by yoga. But she doesn't call it yoga.
Perhaps it wasn't so much a case of you British say tomato and we Indians say tomata, as you call it legs in the air, we call it Savangasana. East and West were in a constant dialogue, each taking what they saw as desirable from the other and making it their own.
H. Broom, 1934. Age-old physical culture of the East. Even modern physical culturists can learn not a little from the yogis.
Physical culture journals in particular, illustrated with photographs, were a kind of global currency. They spread. People in, let's say, Yorkshire or Birmingham or London would read about Indian physical culturists and vice versa. So there was a kind of international vocabulary.
Out of these tangled roots grew many of the now well-known systems of modern yoga. Iyengar with its focus on alignment, meditative Shivananda with its attention to breathing, aerobic Ashtanga with its dynamic flowing sequences. All of these were more readily appealing to a non-Indian audience, one that was set to discover them in a big way in the 1960s.
There's a great upsurge of interest in India. The Beatles famously go and visit the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in Rishikesh, and that enters into their music. And you have the hippie trail to India, young people taking buses to India to study yoga, to study meditation.
Back in Britain, local education authorities realised they had to address the growing demand for yoga classes, but they were sceptical of its hippie associations and hampered by the lack of suitably qualified teachers. Dr. Suzanne Newcombe of the London School of Economics has studied the development of yoga in Britain.
There was a great newspaper article in 1965.
Birmingham tries to size up all this yoga,
which had the subtitle of Prana Force Coming Out of Rates. Kind of, what shall we do about this problem? How do we have a qualified yoga teacher for an adult education authority context?
If there were yoga graduates, would they, on the whole, be quite the sort of person one really wants?
The solution to this quandary came in the late 1960s in the form of the Indian yoga teacher B.K.S. Iyengar. His book, Light on Yoga, had been published to great acclaim and gave him a credible authority. Iyengar had been a student of T. Krishnamacharya in Mysore, one of those great innovators of modern yoga in the 1930s.
B.K.S. Iyengar first came to Britain under the sponsorship of Yehudi Menuhin, who found his teaching personally beneficial for his violin playing, and he brought Iyengar to his house in Highgate for a month every year during the 1960s, and he taught Menuhin a class every day, and then Iyengar was free to try to promote yoga in the rest of the time. Peter McIntosh, who is head of physical education at the Inner London Education Authority, heard about Iyengar, read Light on Yoga, and thought, there's the kind of precision and clarity here that I'd want to promote in the Inner London Education Authority.
There were two stipulations that the Inner London Education Authority made at the outset to Iyengar about what he could teach and what he couldn't. These have shaped yoga teaching outside of India ever since.
They wanted no religious or spiritual content. The teaching should be limited to the instructions necessary for the physical postures or asana and breathing exercises or pranayama. And it wasn't supposed to go beyond that. And it was also supposed to be safe.
This adult education model of yoga rapidly built its appeal with many of the same women whose mothers had been stretching and swinging to Mrs. Bagot Stack's exercises before the Second World War.
The biggest demographic in the adult education evening class system were middle-class housewives. They're not housewives anymore, but still middle-class women. They're the biggest demographic of both yoga practitioners and yoga teachers throughout the Western world. And that really happened with the adult education classes being a safe place for women to go out at night in the 60s.
Back straight, eyes closed, just sitting still for a few breaths.
So that's how I come to be sitting in this class of women every Saturday morning in a church hall in West London.
By chanting Om three times together.
Has learning about yoga's extraordinary multicultural history undermined my actual experience of it? Thankfully, it hasn't. Instead, it's made me really appreciate those outward-looking innovators of the 1930s who reimagined yoga as something that could be practiced by ordinary people. If it wasn't for them, it's unlikely that I, nor millions of others, would be reaping the benefits of yoga today.
Thank you. Namaste, everybody.
You've been listening to The Secret History of Yoga, produced and presented by me, Mukti Jane Campion. The documentary was a CultureWise production for BBC World Service.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.